Thank you so much. Oh, Tawari, I have missed you so much. It's been a busy time in the Dhamma because, you know, I believe that where evil abounds, grace does much more abound. So we haven't been sitting doing nothing, but sometimes the incubation period takes a little longer. And so I'm expecting wonderful things to occur in this world, in spite of what you might see right now, because it's where my hope is placed and where my faith is placed. So I want to introduce you to some of these concepts that we might not engage in on a daily basis, because mostly we're trying to figure out how to make our lives work in this world. And when we get that together, then, you know, we'll think about doing some other things. But what I want to do is, if I could vector you so that you could really grasp what how we have to cultivate ourselves so that we can make this life meaningful without our puny efforts, that's what I hope I can do today. There was a lot more at work than what we think. And this is where the Buddha encourages us to let go of the hindrance of knowledge. Whenever we learn something, that becomes fixed in our mentality, and it becomes the basis for everything else that we learn. So what happens is that we may learn something, and that thing may certainly be true, but once we become fixed around it, anything else that's coming that could increase the potential of that becomes difficult to accept, because we've already accepted something. That's how we end up lowering the bar. And so I want to encourage you today to go back to the Buddha's original teachings, and the teachings of all the Buddhas. All the Buddhas have one mind. And when one enters into that particular stream, it is said that we have changed lineage, and we're no longer ordinary, untaught, run-of-the-mill human beings, but we are reborn, or not, I won't say adopted, I will say reborn into the lineage of the awakened ones. And so I don't care what tradition you come from. Traditions are established by patriarchs of down through different lines of teaching, but there is just one Buddha Dhamma. There's one Buddhism, if you will. So that's my lineage. What's your lineage? It's Buddhism. That's what it is. And holding to the fact that a rose by any name is still a rose. You know, that means that if there are any teachings in any spiritual tradition that align with the teachings of the awakened ones, I mean, you know, like, they don't have to all be Buddhists. You know, Buddhist is a label that we get attached to, and that cuts us off right there. So you're going to hear some things from many other spiritual lineages besides Buddhism today, for those of you who consider it a religion, and I do, in the sense of it being a way of life, not something like we study everything else. It's not a self-development, you know, course, or and it's, I'm going to say this, and I know you'll know what I mean, but it's not just practice. You know, who would want to practice and never play in the real game? And so today I'm going to be talking about what it takes to stop being the water boy, to get off, you know, the way where you show up for every practice, but you never get on the field. It's all about getting on the field. That's cultivation in how we incline the mind and how we speak, and following with the actions and the signs that we are in the flow of the vibration of the mentality of awakened ones. And I read somewhere that said that, you know, we're all Buddhas, that we just don't realize it. And that sounds real good, but that's not correct. It's not that we're all Buddhas. It is true that there is the Buddha nature there, because the Buddha nature permeates everything. I mean, you could call it life, except that it even permeates inanimate objects. So that's the fundamental emptiness, emptiness meaning no particular thing, it encompasses everything. But the difference between us and Buddhists is not that we don't realize it, but because through karmic conditions for so long, we are covered in, my master calls it a stinky skin bag. And that is full of defilements that obscure our capacity, to step in to higher modes of existence and ultimately to recognize who we really are. And that has nothing to do with any sense of an ego person. So we think maybe that becoming enlightened is that Panyawati becomes enlightened. No, Panyawati dies, she dies. And then what, and it's the remainder that is what we're looking at. And as soon as we use the word dies, we get scared. We start backing up, like I think life is to be enjoyed and what's wrong, having a little fun. And, all of these kinds of things. But I'm telling you, don't be afraid of these words, because truly that is the opening, the pathway to our liberation. But we might have to understand the words a little bit differently than we have. You see, we have experiences and then we make up words to describe it. And then we, clamp down around the words, and the words become more significant to us than the experiences. And then we've lost the whole thing. And so we have to have a way of being with words and concepts that make them something like this, but they cannot absolutely define the direct experience. And we talk about, wanting empirical evidence, and we talk about rationality and all of these things. And that sounds good because, like, after all, we're intelligent people, right? But the thing is that we have to admit that those things that really give a quality to life, that really make life worth living, they surprise us. We actually have no worth for it. So one time a woman told me, like, I know your husband. I know him so well. I said, you don't know him as well as I do, because she wasn't living with him. She saw him for a certain number of hours every day and thought that she knew him. But I knew him in the morning and I knew him at night. I knew him when he was good and when he was bad. I knew him at, And so she said, I just love him. I just love him so much. But I knew that she didn't love him in the way that I loved him, because the direct experience, I hope, the direct experience was different, you see. And so the things that matter to us the most, they're really almost undefinable. Only I can know how I feel. Only when you say, oh, I know just how you feel. No, you don't. You just know how you feel about that situation, but you don't know how I feel. And so when we go into start investigating the Dharma, we bring some of these worldly ways of understanding things, and we have to drop that if we want to actually enter into that spiritual world and really understand what is happening. A lot of times a teacher will say to their student, well, they'll say something to them and the student says, really? You think about me that way, or you see that in me? And they can't see it, because they're not looking with a spiritual eye. They're looking with their ordinary eye and the way the world describes and interprets things. But there is another way. There are different levels of consciousness and we're going to open up in a minute. This was just me saying hi. That there are different levels of, we could call it consciousness, but I don't care what you call it, it all involves a living way. There's something about life, and that takes us beyond intellect, this direct experience. And he says the way to know this is through direct experience, if we're not afraid of the words, if we can find different ways to interpret, to understand, to lean into, to allow the words to take on a different meaning for us. And so I'd like to go ahead and open up this morning. And I think Tiweri has, he has the opening song. And
just give
and
me then, the name of it.
Oh, Santi Caro, are you here? Santi?
Yeah, he's here. He may not be able to mute. Hold on a minute.
I see. Okay, if that's too difficult for you.
No, no, it's not. Make sure he can unmute. Give me 1 second.
Oh, I found him. Okay.
Oh, when the master calls from afar, that's what
And then after that, we're doing our opening chant. I think it's the three groups of purifying precepts.
Okay.
Do you see that? So this is we have a choir. this was a song that we wrote, and my assistant teacher today, Venerable Santi Caro. Yes, I do ordain monks too. It's just a, it's a soloist on this, but we're so excited because we took this ragtag group of people, you know, none of us can sing. Well, Santi Caro can sing, but he didn't know he could sing. And I heard his voice, his speaking voice. And I said, "Do you sing?" He said, "No, I dance." He's a choreographer to the stars. And then he decided that there was something missing in his life. And he looked at the Dharma, and this is where he is now. And for this time. And I think it's just wonderful. But I said, "No, you can sing, you get in the choir. Because we need somebody who can sing." And he did. So just enjoy. But from that, we took it from singing to writing songs, to arranging songs, to arranging the music. I even bought a guitar. I haven't started with it yet, but I'm going to start. And it's just to awaken the capacities in us. We can do things that we don't even know we can do. We are in the process of opening a new college. It's called Jijing, that means correct cultivation, learning from Buddha Academy. And I think that this is my last work for real, where we just really want to teach the true fundamentals of the Dharma, not from an American perspective or from an Eastern perspective. You know, but we just want to get to the fundamental teachings, and we'll find that it's not as hard as we think, and we don't have to still be crazy after 20 years of practice, right? Okay, so can we open now? The words are there, so you can like just join in, or you can at least know what we're saying, and then after this song, we will just recite the three groups of purifying precepts.
I just let Tiweri know we can't both share at the same time. So I can share the music, and Tiweri's going to need to stop sharing her screen in order for me to share the music. I'm afraid it won't let me share.
Okay. All right. So you can listen then.
And people are having trouble reading it because it's small. So
okay. No problem.
Let me go find it again. All right. Thanks. Wait. Stop. I gotta share it.
When I'm living without hope,
when I'm living without hope.
When my heart is hurt and my mind confused,
I hear you calling me.
I hear you calling me.
When I'm living on the ropes,
when I'm
living on the ropes.
Going down for the third time.
I hear you calling me.
I hear you calling me. You say, why be afraid to fall, surge and wait? There's just impermanent states of mind. And at once I'm free of false identity. Because the master calls from afar. I hear you calling me. Calling me. I hear you calling me. Calling me.
There is a true unbinding of joy to be received.
When stainless vision rises and we stand undeceived.
Embracing circumstances, our hearts will be relieved.
This is the end of suffering.
Feel like my eyes haven't seen much. Feel like my words don't mean much. From the dirt on the ground that my knees touch, to the sky up above when I reach up, I hear a voice from the distance. And it's calling me to witness. If it's a part of you, it's a part of me. I hear you calling me.
Calling me.
Calling me.
Calling me.
Calling me.
If you wanna be saved.
If you wanna be saved.
From your self-destructive ways, listen to the master.
Calling.
Open to the master.
Calling.
Calling, calling.
To the master,
calling, calling,
calling,
calling, calling,
calling,
calling, calling.
The three groups of purifying precepts. I vow to cut off all evil within me. There will be no evil that I will not cut off. I vow to practice all types of goodness. There'll be no type of goodness I will not practice. I vow to save living beings. There'll be no living beings that I will not save. And these are three precepts that we take. Sometimes the word evil, it's a little bit upsetting to people, but I mean, some things are just plain evil. You don't have to take it like into like a devilish demonic place. Some things just should not be done. And if we think about ourselves, there are some things that we do that just should not be done, you know? And to learn the Dharma, to know the Dharma is to know yourself. And so as long as we leave it out there on the shelf, something that we handle, that we taste, that we examine, we're not going to be able to fully enter into it. It all has to go into us. We have to imbibe it. We have to embody it. And so if we approach learning the Dharma in this way, it moves, it escalates from a place of just learning something to learning something about ourselves. So I forgot the title of this retreat, but it was a great title. And I took it from Sutta number 120.
Was the end game.
Oh yeah.
Was aspiration for the end game.
Aspiration for the end game, that's pretty good. Yeah. So I took it from Sutta number 120, and that sutta is titled Reappearance by Aspiration. So I'm going to start somewhere, like with the purpose of studying, you know, the Dharma, the purpose of studying Buddhism and cultivating ourselves. And a lot of us may be a little bit confused about what that is or exactly what the Buddha said about it, depending on where we have entered the path, you know. But he said that the purpose is to escape from the cycle of reincarnation or rebirth linking. So we know that to achieve this goal is going to be more than the things that we do to bring us a sense of ease, a sense of calm, a sense of peace, you know, in this world. Because some of the things that we do are not going to bring us ease and calm and peace. there's some things that are going to we're going to be confronted with, and we're going to have to absolutely decide where we stand with them. They're going to have to be abandoned, and letting go of things can be painful. We experience it as painful, and so we don't let that go. We might let these things go, but we hold on to that. But it's that right there that is causing the dukkha. But and even if we don't experience dukkha in this life, don't worry about it, because there is the cycle of rebirth linking. Now, some people think that that's a Mahayana concept, and they call it reincarnation. And in the original teachings, they called it rebirth linking consciousness. And in case you haven't read any of those suttas that speak of it in that way, I thought I'd share one with you today. After all, that's the basis of this retreat. And I'm asking you if you will just, I'm not saying that anything else that we do is wrong. I'm just talking about how to make the mark. Whenever the Buddha talked about how to develop oneself, how to cultivate oneself, he always talked about also what the end game was, what the goal was, what the prize was. And if we go too long without reminding ourselves of what the end game is, we'll just get stuck in middle land somewhere, but we'll never see the goal, and we won't move or propel ourselves towards the goal. So in the Sutta 120, he said, bhikkhus, I shall teach you reappearance in accordance to one's aspiration. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. And they said, yes, venerable sir. He said, here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu possesses faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom. And he thinks, oh, on the dissolution of the body after death, I might reappear in the company of well-to-do nobles or well-to-do Brahmins. And it said, he then fixes his mind on that, resolves upon it, develops it. These aspirations and this abiding of his thus developed and cultivation do lead to his reappearance there. This, bhikkhus, is the path, the way that leads to reappearance. And so we have to think about the end game, where it is we ultimately want to go. And we actually do decide that. I mean, we think that this path is so hard, it's so hard, it's so hard to attain. But when the language gets archaic, when we cut out pieces and we craft something completely around that and don't include, it's like having a turkey, Thanksgiving dinner with just a turkey sitting on the table. You know, I mean, Thanksgiving is not Thanksgiving because it has a turkey. It doesn't feel like Thanksgiving without the turkey, but you got to have cranberry sauce. You got to have, you know, stuffing. You got to have all of these things to have a Thanksgiving meal. And so this is talking about how the Thanksgiving meal, everything on the table. And it, but you can pick and choose. Like if you don't want the turkey, you can just have some of that ham, you know, or whatever other. Or if you're vegetarian, you could just have the veggies and leave all the meat there. You see, we choose. And when we choose without knowing what the actual end game is, then we might actually miss the turkey that's right there in front of our faces, sitting right in the middle of the table. And it's the biggest piece of all. No, it's the biggest offering of all. And so he talks about wanting, like, one who looks at people who are notable, they are famous, they are well respected, they have money, they have a status in the community, and say, oh, that I could be like that. And if one's mind lands there and stays there, then they're setting up something that will ultimately become like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So he says, if that's your aspiration, you know, and it will lead to a reappearance there. Now, I don't know about you, but I had enough of life on this plane one of my students told me that she had a reading, and now this is her reading, not mine, right? But she had a reading by someone in a mystery school, and after they gave her the reading, they wanted to tell her something about me. Now, first of all, I think that's invasive, okay? But anyway, because she may have the ability to do that, she may have developed those skills over lifetimes, and they may have matured in this life, or she may have developed them in this life, and but she went on to tell her about me. And she says, well, she's 40,000 years old. I'm like, boy, I'm a slow learner. So she's 40,000 years old, and she doesn't have to come back to this world after this life, but she's gonna choose to come back five more times. I said, that sister does not know me, because if I have a choice, it won't be coming here. I mean, there's a billion galaxies out there that we know of. So how much that we don't know of? And I would choose to come back to this? No, I wouldn't. But you know, we land according to our qualities. So I'm not upset that I'm here, because I understand causality, cause and condition. I know I'm in this realm, in this world, because of my stinking thinking. I know that I'm here, you know, that the fruits of my lives have posited me here. So I just have to deal with this, you know, but I don't have to stay the same. I can use this time to do something else. I'm gonna use this time to study, to learn, to develop, to cultivate, you know, so that the qualities I possess on the dropping off of this body will allow for there to be a reappearance in another world. And so in case you didn't believe in all these worlds and you think these are all mental states, this is what he says, on the dissolution of the body. Okay, that's this. On the falling away of this body, might after death, to make sure you understood, I might reappear in the company of well-to-do nobles or well-to-do Brahmins. Okay. And then he said, again, a bhikkhu that possesses faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom. Hears that the gods of the heaven, of the four great kings, long lived, beautiful, and enjoy great happiness. Or dissolution of the body, of dissolution of this body after death, I might reappear in the company of the gods of the heavens, of the four great kings. I mean, like, that's a better landing place, you know. And he said, this bhikkhu is the path, the way that leads to reappearance there. And again, and what I'm telling you is that it's important to know some things. You know, it's like if somebody blessed you with $1 million and it was direct deposited in your account and you don't know it's there, you won't spend it. But if you know it's there, you will spend it. Yeah. So he went on again, a bhikkhu possesses faith in the other four, and he hears that the gods of the heaven of the 33, the Yama gods, the gods of Tushita heaven, where the Buddha said his wife, his mother had a reappearance, and he went there and he preached the total unbinding to her. It said the gods who delight in creating, the gods who will power over others' creations, that they're long-lived, beautiful, and they enjoy an even greater happiness. And he thinks, on dissolution of the body, you know, after death, may there be a reappearance there. And then he talks about some other levels, you know, in the Buddhist cosmology, it might not say that it's exactly stacked like that, but they speak of 31 planes of existence. And these all have to do with mind streams that are sublime in their occupation, in what they hold within themselves, what they hold within the mind stream, the consciousness. Now, what it does is it says that in order for there to be an appearance, to abide in these places, in these states, we have to have the mind that is equal to, and the virtue that is equal to, the cultivation that is equal to life on that plane. And so he goes on and he talks about the Brahma worlds, and he talks about, and he goes up through all of the planes. And he said, he abides resolved on pervading the beings, that have reappeared there, on pervading the beings that have reappeared there, just as an ornament of the finest gold, very skillfully wrought in the furnace by a clever goldsmith, lying on red brocade, glows, it radiates, and it shines. So if we cultivate that kind of mind, that there is no other place that there could be an appearance, but on the blanket, the velvet, the carpet of that plane of existence. So number one, that helps us accept why we are here. And it helps us to not think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think. It makes us not feel so badly when it comes the end of time to drop off this body, because we have been cultivating, we have been inclining our mind for a reappearance. And he said, through our aspiration, we can attain that. Now, if I get to choose, oh, that's all right. I thought I couldn't choose, but he's telling us that we can choose. Now we have to do the work to qualify, but we can choose. Now this changes my whole view of what I want to make expedient in my life. Do I want a momentary pleasure, but then in the next 30 minutes I'm going to be tormented by you, or do I want to cultivate myself in such a way that I'm in a place, there are lots of places we could be living right now. I could be living in a ghetto where I hear gunshots going off every day, and I see people dropping like flies. I could be in a war zone. And, I know everybody is talking about, what is happening in the Ukraine right now. And, and everything has another side of something that we must look at. And it's terrible, terrible what is happening in Ukraine right now. But I can tell you, before the war started in Ukraine, a few weeks ago, there's some places in Africa, they've been warring for the last 30 years, and there's been genocide going on for the last 30 years. So sometimes we like pigeonhole and we see something and that's so terrible, but it's going on all over the world. Some of us who live right here in this country have been subjected to horrible atrocities. Our children, our parents, our grandparents, And so we can't get stuck on something. We just need to really see the nature of man and how myopic we are. They were telling, it was on, they haven't put it on TV. I read it in the newspaper the other day, how the education is cheaper there. So you have a lot of the students from Africa who go to study there, and they were not allowing the Blacks to get on the trains to leave Ukraine, even though they live in Ukraine now because they're going to college. I haven't seen one on television, but then I listened to the comments of the commentators, and said, these are people that look like us. I'm looking, I'm seeing these things happen to people who are white like me, who have blue eyes. Now, I can talk about this because I don't hold anything against anybody. I mean, if I had decided, I probably could have decided, I probably wouldn't have chosen to be Black in America. Okay, so it wasn't our choice. So we don't have to hold anything against anyone. We've had this appearance, and due to our ignorance, we flow in the culture of the world that gives us our values. And so that's how it is. And that's this world. Don't like it, don't come back here again. And so I'm saying all of this to say that we think things are not within our control, and we blame people for things that is no need to blame them for. And that is the state of ignorance, and we have to understand causality, cause and condition. And when we do that, we stop attacking people. We see a bigger problem here. We see a bigger picture of what causes pain and suffering. And it's not so much an individual's mind, but it is the greed, the hatred, the delusion. Generally, we could say the ignorance of the human species that is causing these problems. And so the greatest, I feel, the greatest and the highest, you know, they call it engaged Buddhism, because I did something for some people, you know, I came on the scene in that way because that's all I could do. I didn't know that much Dharma at that time. So 20 years ago, I did what I could do. I could feed somebody. I could house somebody. I could help somebody. You know, but over the years, as I began to learn the Dharma, I began to have more skills. I could do more things. I could speak to people. I could understand how their mind inclined and maybe give them another way of looking at things. You know, so that's how the Dharma impacted me. That's how I drank it. And that's how I release it back to the world. So the greatest thing now, I'm engaged in making sure people can plainly understand the Dharma, you know, so that we can make some progress. We need to make progress, not take up a study for 20 or 30 or 50 years and spout empty theories, but we should have the attainment and the accomplishment that comes through penetrating this Dharma. That's what I'm saying. And it is available to us. Sometimes you only have to be off just a nano inch, if that's a thing, but as you go further and further down, just that little bit of offness ends up being such a chasm, you know, that you're no longer on the path, no longer on the road, but just you're saying all the words that pertain to the path, you know, but we're not on it. You know, the thing about bad people or evil people are they believe in their badness. They believe they can win with that badness, but good people don't have that much faith and confidence in goodness. We think it's a little bit feeble, a little bit impotent, you know, but I have great confidence in goodness. And if I'm not seeing goodness prevail, then that means that the bad people are better at being bad than the good people are at being good. And that's not goodness's fault. That's our fault. We have to check ourselves. We have to make sure we're on the path, and we have to not be afraid of the path. If you're afraid of the path, get off it. And when I was in, I was a Christian for many, many, many years. Oh man, I love that path. I love that path. I love that path. But anytime, you know, as you age, you turn 17, you turn 18, you want to do some things, you know, you turn 25, you want to do some other things. So anytime I felt like, I was being constricted by the church. No, I wasn't going to stay in church and like tip around. No, when I decided to be bad, I just left the church. I went out and I went full throttle. I was just like, and then when I'd had enough of that, or either I got tired of it or I was suffering too much, I left that completely and I come back to the church. You know, so I might have done a little double dutch, but I wasn't lukewarm, hot or cold. That's just it, you know. And what I have found is even when we completely abandon something so that we're in a place that we can really see ourselves, really see our suffering, really see our cruelty, really see our negative mind, that we can really see that. And it's not colored with, there's a little bit of light up there. You know, I think I'm all right. Maybe it's just the angle of the mirror. You know, when we know where we are, then we can develop some resolve and we can really see that thing as it is and we can abandon. And that's all the Buddha's talking about when he talks about renunciation, having a heart of renunciation. It's no point in saying, well, there's some good things in the world too. We know that, but is it enough? If it was enough, we wouldn't be on this path. We wouldn't be searching for something if it was enough. So we don't have to make a case for the good, you know, the good things in the world. So does it take all of that? Yes, it takes all of that. But the thing is that it doesn't seem like a chore at all. If we follow his path of how to step in it, but we're so used to efforting in the worldly way. We're so used to relying upon the intellect to tell us what is what. And so, you know, the mind that creates a problem is not going to be the mind that can take care of the problem. You know, there's another way of thinking that we have to have, another way of holding things, another way of seeing things, a revision of the structure of appearances. you know, that will allow us to do something in a different way. So the minute we start relying so consciously on our conceptual thinking and our reasoning, our rationale, I looked up Webster's definition of reason, and I looked up Webster's definition of intuition. And that definition of intuition was boss and bad. It was what the Buddha talks about when he says it's a knowing based on direct experience. And that's different than the mind coming up with what something is, because the Buddha said that, you know, our five senses, they're not reliable. We can't fully rely on what we think and hear, five senses and the mind. So he made it six senses. What we see, hear, see, taste, touch, smell, and think, because we see partially. We hear in part. We hear according to how we think. That's why something can happen in a room. And you ask five people what happened, and they got five different stories about what happened and how it happened, you know? And so he says, you have to rely on it some, because that's all you got to work with here. You got to rely on it some. He says, but when it comes to this, you're not going to be able to fully rely on that. You're going to have to take some of it by, and he called the first one is the F word, faith. That means that when you recognize that through observation, he said, observe somebody for a long time, but through observation, you see a person who's able to like handle whatever life deals them in the course of a day. You know, they can, they're self-possessed. They have a view and a way of being that you find inspiring, that encourages you, that is steady, that you know that that's a friend that sticks closer than a brother, that you know you're looking for certain qualities. And when you recognize them, mostly those are qualities that you don't have. You know, I wasn't looking for people who had qualities I had. I was enough for me. But I was looking for those who had qualities that inspired me, or that I have, that I desired. You know, one of the hardest practices that I had was to learn to overlook a slight and to tolerate a fault. No, I'd just rather beat you down. And I'd just leave you bloodied on the street, you know, because that's how I took care of myself, you know? But when I looked at that one who wasn't perturbed, who didn't get upset, you know, who could look past a person's indiscretion, with compassion towards them. So if he knew me, he wouldn't think that way about me. You know, who could do that? I'm like, that's a more noble way of being. And I had a desire for that kind of nobility. I still have a desire for it. I'm not saying that I have attained it, but I'm sure not like I was, you know? And so I can see the progress, and that gives me courage in the path, but it's not easy. I had to, you know, take down. Actually, taking down does not feel good at all. It feels like, I mean, it's this excruciating pain, embarrassment, mental suffering. Even the body jumps in it, your heart starts beating fast, and your head goes crazy, you see red. It's like all of this is happening, you know. But I wanted to cultivate that kind of ability to maintain my dignity, to keep myself, you know, and it didn't feel good in the beginning. But when I was able to do it, and I might start, but can't finish it, you know, like I'm gonna be patient for about 3 minutes and then you're gonna get it, you know. But in time, I could become more patient. I can like throw my hands up like he's not listening today. So we're going to end this conversation. And then I go away and come back tomorrow. But when I come back tomorrow, I'm coming back like this is the first day. We're going to start again, you know, and see if we can just be friends. And we may make a little progress. Sometimes I even laugh. That's how I got into the laughter. You know, in the Bible, it says, if I say to myself, I shall put on a happy face, then shall my countenance be changed. Now, so we have to say something to ourselves, you know, and then we can step into that which we say to ourselves. If I say, oh, I want to be happy, you know, I'm so tired of being sad. I just really want to be happy, you know, but, you know, but we have to actually put some feet behind the aspiration. And if we, and these are, I'm not talking about learning, you know, they say there are 88,000 Dharma gates, you know, that lead to awakening. I'm not talking about all those 88,000 Dharma gates. I'm talking about right here, right now, Panyawati. What shall I be? What shall I do? How shall I act? And the Buddha is telling us that we can have a reappearance in the heavenly abodes simply by deciding that and inclining our mind towards what that takes. Now, that's something everybody can do. I might not be able to settle the war in Ukraine. I may not, you know, be able to correct reform the whole social justice system. It didn't happen overnight. It's not going to be fixed overnight. And even if we fixed it on the books, laws are laws, but people operate them. And so until minds and hearts change, I don't care how many laws you got on the books. When I would go to India, you know, they had an anti-atrocity law since 1950. But it doesn't mean that they're operating in that law there, because men meaning humankind, men there feel that they honestly believe that some are, you know, come from the head of Brahma, and some come from the chest of Brahma, and some from the loins of Brahma, and some from the feet of Brahma, and some didn't come from Brahma at all. And they call them untouchables, you know, they call them non-humans. And I look at two Indians, they look the same to me. You know, but in every place, I'm not picking on India, that's just direct experience. And I'm saying, so I can't go over there and say something that's gonna, I can't do something that's gonna change their mind about and make them operate in that law if that's what their belief system, their faith is. So I have to do something else. I have to approach them in a different way that they can see one man as the next, to destroy that kind of unbeneficial thinking. You know, it's just based on, you know, on an ignorance and a kind of worldly perspective of how they actually call it the how to make a society successful. Everybody stay in your lane. So if you're born into a family where you do laundry, that's what you do. And it said, I didn't know that, right? So I'm going there and I'm helping people with upward mobility because I'm a do-gooder, I am. Yeah, so I'm going there and I'm helping teach. I bought a brick making machine, because where in one village, the untouchables, all they had was dirt. They didn't have anything else. So I said, okay, well, we can take the dirt and we can make bricks, you know, and then you can sell the bricks and you can feed your families. I thought it was a great idea. There was nothing else. They couldn't grow vegetables, you know, it was nothing. So I spend several thousand dollars, right? And I get a brick making machine and I send them off to a place to learn brick making. I took 10 men from the village and they learn how to make bricks. They come back and make bricks. You know, I almost got the whole village slaughtered with my do-goodiness, because they consider, if you teach occupationally, and it's changing now, it's been 15 years and some things are slowly changing. But when I was there, just having the zeal, you know, and not always having the wisdom, that's when I realized I need to sit down and learn something. I need to figure out how to help. And so what happened was, because I was, there's a bricklaying caste. And they came to slaughter those untouchables because it was taking their occupations, you know. And I had to apologize. I didn't know. I didn't understand, you know. And I we can't do that. But they were so desperate, they were willing to do anything because they thought the girl from America could save them. I can't save you in India, you know? And so I say that to just say that sometimes we're wanting to do things, but we have to have the wisdom to know how to do it. There are many ways I was able to help, building wells and refurbishing schools and paying for school supplies so that the children could be educated so that they could learn another way. And then somebody else who had political clout in a village could then help them politically to have some voice, you know, but I couldn't go over there and do that. And so in these ways, we learn how to offer our own brightness, that which we possess, and not think that it's a little thing, it's a trifling thing. So could you think today, this afternoon, Santi's gonna take you into an excursion around your brightnesses, your skillfulness that you can have, and so that we can see how much whatever we have to offer is needed. And when we polish it and offer it, that's enough. That's enough. But it does something for us too. It sets us up on a path of awakening because we come to know ourselves and we abandon that little thing that has been with us lifetime after lifetime that we have not recognized was even there, was even present. And so this reappearance by aspiration talks about what happens when we go into jhana and why jhana is so important. Because after he goes through all the God realms where there could be a reappearance, this is Sutta number 120. You can read it for yourself. Don't take my word for it. And it says, again, a bhikkhu who possesses, you know, these five qualities, he hears that the Brahma of 100,000 is long-lived, beautiful, and enjoys a different kind of happiness. And he abides resolved on pervading the beings that have reappeared there. And then when he gets to all of those, the gods of radiance, including limited, immeasurable, and streaming, the gods of glory, the gods of refulgent glory. It goes on to the Sudasa gods, the Sudasi gods. He thinks on the dissolution of the body after death, I might reappear in the company of those beings. Okay, and then he goes on and he talks about the base of infinite space. And so now we're into the jhanas. You get to the four material jhanas, you go into the four immaterial jhanas. And that's why jhana cultivation and attainment is so important, you know, because as we start touching the jhana of infinite space or the jhana of infinite consciousness, of the base of nothing, or neither perception nor non-perception. There are beings that abide on that plane, on those planes, with a certain mind, with a certain consciousness, and we can also attain and have a desire and aspiration for reappearance on those levels. And then he goes on finally and talks about that place that is where the deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom are taintless with the destruction of the taint. So I ask you today, you know, in all the other things that you're doing, have you cultivated and developed an aspiration for reappearance? So now this taintless place, we could think, because that's like the highest place, right? The pure abodes. How could we possibly have that taintless place? I think I'm gonna stop for a minute right now. And I'm gonna ask us, that's why I can't put together a retreat in advance. I don't know where I'm going, you know, But we can get the signals. How do we get those signals? What's the point in having an aspiration for abiding in a certain realm of consciousness if it's not possible, if it's possible to have an aspiration for abiding in that way? Don't you think it's possible then to develop affinity for the beings in those realms, and they have a capacity to also connect with us? I call it getting the signal. You can call it whatever you want to call it, you know, but for me, it's like getting a signal. And so because I continually have that aspiration, not only for myself, but for all beings who are on the path and for beings who are not on the path, you know, then I can call upon those beings with that high mind. I have a Cambodian nun. She's the second Cambodian to be ordained. And I said I wasn't doing any more of that, but you know, things happen. People show up and you have to do what you have to do. So I'm training Sada now. And Sada is going to be going to a Theravadan country. So like, you know, like I wear different robes. I wear the robes of different traditions. Sometimes I don't wear a robe at all, you know, it's just really upsetting to some of the monks, but you know, I really understand the purpose of a robe. I don't see anything in this robe as so holy. Now, of course, another can look upon the robe and be inspired, and that's good for the one looking upon the robe. But for the one wearing the robe, that one can't have an arrogance about the robe. That's what I'm saying. So they're just clothes to me, you know. I'm sitting here trying to, and we're doing a lot of Vajrayana practice. We're doing, but she's going to a Theravadan country. So there's no point in me teaching her a lot of the Theravadan, the Vajrayana Dharma gates, right? Because she's not going to be able to affect the people with those practices, you know, because they're steeped in something else. So she needs to use some, if there are 88,000 Dharma gates, then maybe there's 35 of them, a Theravada view Dharma gates, use some of those. And so I'm trying to teach her some of those, but she comes and she sits in our Vajrayana stuff. One day she comes, venerable, that's high Dharma. That's high Dharma, you know, because of the things that we were talking about. And I said, but she doesn't speak English that well, you know, that's why this is taking a long time. She doesn't speak English well, she doesn't. And she understands English even less well. But she said, you know, I sit venerable. And when I go back to my room, she said, I just know. I know what you just taught. She said, something comes to me and I know, I understand. She said, but that's high Dharma. You know, she said, that's Dharma for me. And I teach the people this, something for them, you know? And so now that's what I'm talking about, a direct experience. She can't get that out of books. She can't read English books. You know, she doesn't understand much English that's said, but there is the transmission of the energy and the support of the heavenly beings that help her to understand it and to get it, so that she becomes empowered, and then she can teach people what she needs to teach them, you know. I was gonna say on their level, but that's wrong. It's not on their level, but of their preference, right? Of their preference. See, Tawari, I'm changing my words. It's a never-ending practice for us. But I want us to stop for a minute. I want you to ask yourself, have you ever read that sutta? If anybody's read it, can you raise your hand? Okay, I see one hand. Okay. Yeah. So I would encourage you to read that sutta. It's something that sets up an attitude, you know. Things are more like attitude as opposed to absolute. You know, the Buddha doesn't dictate anything. He just said, y'all might want to check that out. You might want to look over there for what you're trying to accomplish. You know, or you're struggling too hard. You might want to think about this right here. You know, so sometimes we're working so hard, you know, around what we think we need to work so hard at, you know, because that's our way of achievement in the world, our way of attaining something in the world. But this is truly otherworldly. Now, what happens in the world is impacted upon. All worldly Dhamma is Buddha Dhamma, you know, but it's how the attitude we have towards it, how we lean into it, how we hold it, where we place it, how we use it. And it's not through striving in the human worldly sense of striving, but it's more like laboring to enter into the rest that is available. That's harder for us who are used to, you know, accomplishing by power and by might. But he's talking about something else. So when we are sitting in meditation, for instance, and we're thinking about, you know, we're not, we're working. We're not like just letting go for a while. You know, we're not like just relaxing and letting go. We're working, but there's a way that we work. And he's giving us a way. He says, first incline your mind towards something. Have an aspiration. If you don't know where you're going, how will you know when you get there? Have an aspiration for something. If you don't know about the different realms as described about the Buddha, research them out. I just love Google. I have 10,000 books, but when I want to know something, I just Google. You know, Google can find it faster. It'll tell me where it is, and then I go get the hard copy, and I can just look it right up. You know, I don't have to look through 50 books. But I do use the books. As you can see, my books are well-worn, and this is about my fifth Majjhima Nikaya, because I just wear them out, you know, because I continually remind myself. I keep going back to the beginning, that beginner's mind we talk about. I keep going back to the beginning and keeping it simple. Kiss. I just keep it simple. But in keeping it simple, my mind doesn't begin to proliferate and just, what about this? Or what about that? Or what about the other, which we're going to talk about next. But before we go to how the mind is constantly thinking, let's reflect for a few minutes on our aspiration. Do we have one? And where does that land us? Do we have an aspiration for happiness in this world with all of its troubles? We have to duck and dodge, bob and weave. We have to deal with our own defilements. The good I would do, I don't do. What I don't want to do, I do. We deal with our greed, our hatred, our delusion, our jealousy, our envy. We deal with the pain of loved ones coming into our life and going out of our life. He says, suffering is born from those who are dear. And there are many people dying all over the world right at this moment, right as we speak. But I don't feel it like I feel it when a loved one of mine dies. Yes, I feel for them. I relate to it, but it's different when my own dies. Yeah. I know there's injustice in the justice system, you know, and I feel for people wrongly accused and for people, you know, who commit a minor offense and get a major life sentence, all of that. I feel for them, but I don't feel for them like I would feel for if it was my father, my son, my brother, my sister, my mother. I don't feel like it. As if it were for me, as if it was happening to me. Yes, I know there's all kinds of race injustice going on everywhere, and it's not just colors, it's people of the same colors, clans, it's cliques, it's all of this. But how would I feel if it was actually happening to me and to mine? I know this, you know, there's inflation going on, and some of us are comfortable. I'm saying some, but I'm not really included in that number of being financially comfortable. I'll just say I have food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. And the Buddha said, you know, be grateful for that, because some don't have that. So I can say I have that, and I can be satisfied with that. Yeah. But some don't have that. One of my nun sister, Claire Grace, is on. She's traveling around the whole United States, visiting the most impoverished or divided communities in every state. And right now, she's going through the South, and she said, "I've been to hell." You know, she said. She called me last night. She was just leaving, I think she said, Mississippi. And she said, "I've seen things," she said, "I wouldn't believe in this day and time, attitudes." And she's a person of color, she's Black. And she's traveling in this van. She said, "One morning I woke up, because I sleep in the parks and places like that. And then I go visit the homeless people who are in those parks. And when people have given me donations, I buy them food. But mostly I sit and I talk with them and I let them know that somebody cares. And even though I can't change their condition, you know, I see them." And that's what she's doing. And she's got stories, I tell you. And I actually, I feel, you know, that she's doing a great work there, but she says, "Is it not much I can share with them?" And it's so true. When they asked me to come to India, they wouldn't ask me to come and teach the Dharma, you know? And I said, "Okay, I'll come," you know? But when I went over there and I saw the conditions, I said, "Dharma not gonna help these people, you know? But right now, these people need a place where their girls can go to the bathroom that's not in the front yard, so that they can have some dignity and so that they won't get raped tomorrow, you know." So I started with toilets, you know, and then some planting so they'd have some food. Then they needed well water to be able to, you know, irrigate the crops and to have pure drinking water, because they were having all kinds of disease. I mean, you have to like not despise small beginnings. Don't despise it within yourself. Don't think that you're useless and without purpose. Think of one little thing that you can do. Don't have any illusions about how good we are and how much we do, and yet don't have any illusions about how bad we are and how useless we are. Get our mind stabilized in a middle place. And sometimes we lean a little this way, the Buddha said. Sometimes, like on a high wire, we lean a little to the other side. He said, you can't just walk straight across. There's a little leaning to the left and a little leaning to the right. As the winds of adversity blow and hit you, that means that sometimes we can't do the best. Sometimes we just have to do our best. And it may not be good enough to fix the problem, but at least we've started. One plants, another waters, another gets the increase. And if we start seeing life in this kind of way, we will see our integration and our flow. And we won't be so discouraged when we see things that are ugly. And we won't be too happy when we see things that are good. Because we know on the heels of good comes disruption. This is a world of opposites. Everything is compared. This compared to that gives us our frame of reference for everything. And in this way, we start to become more flexible, more even-heeled. We can start to set the temperature in a room rather than to register the temperature. I vow to cut off all evil within me. I vow to cultivate all good within me. And just sitting and contemplating what that means. I don't know what evil is in you, and I don't know what good is in you. I'm not even that sure about myself. I'm learning every day what evil is in me and what good is in me through the ways that I think, the ways that I speak, the ways that I act. And cultivation is simply self-correcting. I don't want you to correct me, but I can correct myself. When I find a teaching too hard to take right now, I can say, oh, that's something to have an aspiration towards. I can't do that today, but I want to be able to do it. And I just set it right there, not out of view, but where I can see it. And I just look at it. I just glance over at it. One day you wake up, today is the day I have my legs under me, and you step into that thing. And oh, just the sense of accomplishment and the rooting of faith in the path, not even in oneself. That's how one uproots the sense of self, to see the glory of the path. It's like walking on a dusty road. If you walk on a dusty road and you look down, you have dust on your shoes, right? No way not to. If I had a son and I sent him out in the field to work, and he comes back in and I look down, he has no dust on his shoes. I know he hasn't been in the field working. And if we, who call ourselves on the path, cannot see the good works, not thinking of, I am so good, what a good girl am I, you know, but just simply the works speak for themselves. The attainment is there, the capacity to hold things, you know, the desire to do things and the right attitude as we undertake them and complete them too. And as we do that, we see, we confirm, we verify that we are in fact on the path. So just thinking right now, without shame, not gonna ask anybody to confess anything to others, just acknowledge to oneself the evils that I must abandon, the good that I must undertake. When I line up with the Dharma, I become the Dharma, and self is forgotten. That's how we get to know self. So just take stock and inventory right now.
To you, everything I have, to you, withholding nothing, withholding nothing, I
ding.